It's 5:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, costs for federal assistance to families who have children with disabilities have outstripped traditional welfare, according to some new data. Some say the system needs to be reworked.
First, last March, when Paris found itself sitting under a cloud of particle pollution, the city opted to try something new. It alternating driving days and made mass transit free for buses, trains, and subways.
The experiment worked. Traffic congestion eased by 20%. Pollution fell by about 30%. So in cities with gridlock and pollution problems and everyone downwind from them, our guest says free mass transit is worth a closer look.
Henry Grabar joins us now. He's an urban affairs journalist in New York who writes the Dream City column for Salon. Henry, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks, guys.
So, Henry, how often has this idea of free mass transit been tried?
Well, you know, there's a few dozen cities in the United States where mass transit systems are free, although they're mostly quite small. It's usually university towns. Some mountain towns that have ski resorts have free transit systems. But this test case in Paris that you mentioned was probably the biggest single city to really free up its mass transit. It's been tried in a number of large cities, but only for short periods of time as a sort of a boost designed to achieve a result like it did in Paris. Actually, this year is sort of a big moment because the capital of Estonia, Tallinn, which is a city of 430,000 people, just made its mass transit system free. And so it becomes the biggest test case by far in trying out this policy.
So how does it work? There's transit. I stop at the stop. I get on. No questions asked.
Yeah, that's about the size of it. I mean, you know, part of the idea here is that you have a lot of transit systems where they actually make back a very small portion of their budget at the fare box. So by sort of eliminating the fare box, you don't actually lose the system that much money, and maybe you even save a little money because of the cost of employing people to sell tickets and the cost of printing the tickets and providing the ticket machines and maintaining those, et cetera. So in systems where it's been tried, yeah, that's just it. You just get on the bus or the train and go for a ride.
So do we have a sense of who exactly began, you know, in Paris this last year riding public transit that wouldn't have done it before, maybe would have gotten in the car?
Right. So the thing about the situation in Paris, which is unfortunate, is that they have no way of keeping track of how many people are riding transit except by counting how many tickets are taken and how many passes are scanned. So in March, when they made the system free, they basically just opened up all the gates. And so we don't know how many people actually got on the metro that day that otherwise wouldn't have. We do know how much traffic dropped, which is a significant amount. We know that pollution dropped by a bunch as well. In general, I think the idea is that you have drivers who are making a choice, and you have commuters who are making a choice, and they're sort of weighing their options. And cost is only one of those options, although for a number of people, it's a significant choice they have to make. I think in Paris especially, where you have a system where the cost of transit is sort of measured based on how far away you live. So if you live quite far out in the suburbs, you could end up paying $10 just to get into the city one way. And so when you take that cost away, I think that creates a significant incentive for people to sort of decide not to use their cars that day.
So can you lay out some of the benefits? We touched on them just briefly in the setup there. What are the benefits when a city goes to a free transit system?
Well, I think the idea on the part of planners is basically that you can really boost the number of people that are on transit, and that has a number of effects. For one thing, it reduces traffic congestion and would free up the roads for people who really need to use it, and for delivery vans and buses and sort of other road traffic. The other thing would be that by reducing congestion, it cuts air pollution, which is good for everybody. And then another side effect would be that by making transit free, you increase people's mobility. And it's hard to measure exactly how those effects, manifest themselves. But one of those would be that it would be a lot easier for people to get to jobs, to go shopping, to see their friends, and just generally a a sort of higher circulation of people throughout the city. And that has, you know, good social effects because you have people going out. It also has good economic effects because you have people going to restaurants, you have more jobs that are accessible to more people living in more places, and just generally a sort of more mobile population.
And we read a lot about how one of the challenges for the working poor is getting to that job in the morning. Could this help in that area as well?
Yeah, I think that's definitely part of the idea. You know, the cost of transportation in this country is really high, and it's something that I think goes it often doesn't get enough play. People talk a lot about the cost of housing. Housing is what Americans spend the most money on, but transportation is a close second. And especially if you own a car, I mean, the cost of that can be, I think, on average, about $10,000 a year if you include all the sort of gas payments, insurance, the cost of the depreciation of the vehicle. And so, you know, in cities where you have really developed transit systems like New York, people spend a lot less money getting from place to place. And so that's a positive thing. And I think the idea is if you can get people to take transit, you can really make their sort of commute a little easier. Now, of course, free transit is not a solution to this. If you have a city that or a county or a state with a totally insufficient transit network, making it free might not make a whole lot more people get on it. You know, that's, like I said, that's only one of the things that people consider. So we shouldn't overstate. It's not a magic solution to get everybody riding buses and trains. But in certain cases, it seems that it can have a pretty big effect.
So just because there's no fare doesn't mean it's ultimately free. Somebody's got to pay the expenses. When we take away fares, who ends up picking up the difference? Who ends up paying?
Well, you know, there's a lot of different ways that that can happen. I think, and the idea of making transit free is the sort of culmination of a long process that's gone on for about a century in rethinking the way we consider transit. You know, in the early 20th century, the companies that were running urban streetcars, that were running subways, these were private companies, and they were making a lot of money doing it, in part through real estate sales. And so to somebody 100 years ago, the idea of subsidizing transit or making it free would have seemed ludicrous. But since then, times have changed. A big part of this is how much federal money and tax dollars goes into providing free roads. And so I think people who advocate for free transit would make that analogy. They would say, well, we provide free roads. Why not provide free transit and give transit a chance at pulling some commuters along? In terms of what actually funds it, that depends by jurisdiction. One of the sort of pioneers of this policy is a French city called Châteauroux, which is about it's a very small city. It's about 50,000 people. But they made transit free in 2001, and they had some pretty spectacular results. They had their ridership per person go up from 21 trips a year to 61, so it tripled. And ridership is up 208% in 11 years. And what they did was they enacted a small tax on the businesses in the Central Business District. And as it turned out, it seems that they were quite happy. They kept electing the same mayor who enacted this policy. He's still the mayor there. And they were quite happy with this policy because I guess though they were paying for you know, the removal of the fares on the transit system, there were so many more people getting downtown on transit that at the end of the day, the boost to business must have made it pay off for them.
And does it seem as though people keep using the free transit once they start, that there's not just a sort of a novelty factor and that eventually people tire of, you know, being crammed on a crowded bus next to people and they want to go back to their, you know, privacy of their own car?
Yeah, well, you know, it depends. In the places, there have been several places in America that have tried it and then stopped. And the biggest complaint, what is it? I think Austin did a big experiment where they did something like that. Topeka has done something similar, Asheville, North Carolina. And they've all had actually huge gains in ridership. But like I said, these are only trial periods, at the end of which the two central complaints are that the buses, and they are buses in this case, are too crowded. And the secondary complaint is that you tend to get people who just ride them all day. which the regular commuters aren't so fond of. And that might be homeless people or teenagers or just people looking to sort of hang out. And so that's been an issue. And, you know, in terms of it being a novelty, it's hard to say. It seems certainly the free transit seems to have a larger effect in smaller communities where people have a choice between using their car or using transit. It has less, it's a less influential policy in big cities where the theory is, at least, that people are, they don't have as much of a choice. If you live in a place like New York or even more so in London or Paris, most people don't own cars. There's congestion pricing on driving. Traffic is terrible. And people really don't have a choice about whether to take transit or not. So in that sense, making it free doesn't change that many people's minds. In America, at least where it's been tried, it seems like it has had a pretty big effect on ridership. But like I said, most of those cases in sort of sizable cities have been temporary trial periods, and none of them have stuck.
Henry Grabar is with us now. He's an urban affairs journalist in New York who writes the Dream City column for Salon. Would we have, do you think, less pollution, fewer cars, more riders if we made mass transportation free? That's our question right now.
And we'd love to hear your answer to that question. Would free mass transit improve pollution, ease congestion? Would you ride the bus or train if it were free and available in your area? Should we think about mass transit as a necessary public service in communities big and small? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
If we had free mass transit for things like buses and trains, we'd maybe have less pollution, fewer cars on the road, and maybe more riders. Well, that's what our guest is wondering. Henry Grabar is with us. He's an urban affairs journalist in New York who writes the Dream City column for Salon.
And we'd love to hear what you think about this. Would free mass transit improve pollution, road congestion? Would you ride the bus or the train where you are if it were free? If it's not available where you are, would you like to see something like this where you are? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we go now to our first caller. Marcus joins us now in Green Bay. Hi, Marcus.
Hi. I'm just calling. I think that we need to look forward to a new form of transportation, going with something like robotic or automated cars, vehicles. And they can be of varying sizes. That way, you don't have the congestion. You can make them electric. They know when to plug themselves in. They know when to drive where. And that way, there can be a computer that figures out when and where you need cars. So if I drive to work, we'll say I commute from Appleton to Green Bay. It knows that there are 10 people between my place of work and where I go to work that it can pick up along the way. So it can work, it thinks for itself, or not thinks for itself, but it figures out the path of least resistance to carry the most possible people on a day-to-day basis.
All right. An interesting prospect, Marcus. You know, I've read about such things. You're looking quite a bit into the future there. But what about, you know, being a little more forward-thinking, Henry, and looking at something like that and gearing our system in that direction?
Well, I think a lot of people who look at cities and sort of futurists who think about the way technology is going are very excited about that possibility. And Marcus is right that it, not only does it have the possibility to sort of revise the way we think about public transport and people getting around, but really to restructure cities. And in a way, I think, you know, the goals aren't so different here. It's about sort of reducing the reliance on individual automobiles, and I think part of the reason people really look forward to the driverless car era beginning is because it will be so much more efficient, you know, just to be able to get everybody into the sort of have one car rotating around, and that's going to have to force cities to make some choices, which I think, you know, I guess the broader point being that it would be good for cities and states and people generally to start thinking about what their government's responsibility is in terms of providing transportation, and whether that's making a bus free now or at some point in the future, providing a fleet of driverless cars to get people around. I mean, it's just a question of, you know, what would be the benefits of that, and how much responsibility for that falls to the city or the county?
Well, that reminds me, you say we in part need to start thinking of mass transit more as a public service instead of a business sector sort of thing. Is that a hard sell?
You know, in some places it is, and in some places it isn't. I think it depends a lot on your perspective. It seems to be taken for granted in most places that students and seniors ride free on buses and trains. And so, you know, if you're skeptical about the idea of making transit free, you should think about why we offer free rides to students and seniors. And in the case of students, it's because while they might be able to pay for it themselves, we think that the increased mobility is a good thing for them. Many of them can't drive. We don't want to burden their parents. And you know, it's good for them to be able to get to the public library, to a sports game, and then back home. And for seniors, it's a similar sort of process of sort of figuring out what we want out of society and what we want seniors to be able to do, to be able to get around without driving. And some of the externalities of this are sort of, some of the benefits can be measured economically. It's that, you know, if we get seniors off the road, then we won't have them driving and causing accidents, and that would be a good thing. But mostly, I think it's a sort of idea of a social good that people are focused on. So I guess the question would, you know, I think you can make similar arguments when you talk about just regular everyday people riding mass transit. So,
all right. And let's go back to our phones. Julie joins us now in Madison.
Hello.
Hi, Julie. What do you think?
Well, I certainly support the idea, and I work for an employer that provides free bus passes. However, you know, I'll have to say I don't take advantage of it very often because either the schedule isn't conducive to, you know, my timing, or there's things I have to do after work that the bus doesn't take me there. So it just doesn't always work out that it's feasible for, I guess, my schedule and lifestyle.
Gotcha. Thanks, Julie, for that perspective. And you know, this gets at this aspect you were talking about earlier, Henry, that, you know, if you don't have a good mass transit system already, this may not work so well. But is this idea something where a city, if they're interested, could step up their game and really get their mass transit system working well and serve people that way?
Well, I think one advantage of talking about free mass transit is, for one thing, it grabs headlines and it gets people talking about transit and gets people thinking about, you know, like Julie was saying, where, you know, what would really benefit me in terms of what sort of services are being provided. And unfortunately, transit authorities and associations sort of have a reputation for being difficult to get to, bureaucratic, stuck in their ways. And I think that, you know, when we start thinking about what we can ask them for and what sort of services would be more beneficial, you know, obviously making a system free is only part of that. But it gets to the same thing, you know, thinking about what you want to ask for. And I guess the other part of it is that, you know, in cities that have tried it as a sort of a giveaway opportunity, you do end up, even if it's a short novelty type thing, with a lot more people riding. And in turn, that makes people, you know, taking the bus for the first time in years, you know, say to themselves and ask themselves and maybe ask their representatives, why don't I do this more often? What's preventing me from doing this? And then you get to talk about things like routes and frequency and what type of services are provided. And again, those are the fundamental issues.
Time for one more quick call from Dave in Wausau. Dave, hi.
Well, hey, happy Thursday, everyone. I had the privilege of hanging out in Germany for a year when I was in the Army. And I, you know, I'm an American, and I don't speak language, but I had to get around the town, and I found that their system of buses and trains were very precise. And if you were behind time, you missed your ride, dang it, and that was a tough thing. Now, fast forward, here I'm living in San Diego. And I've since moved here to Wausau. But at the time that I'm in San Diego, the whole thing about mass transportation is a big topic. The big rail line that Schwarzenegger wanted to put in between Los Angeles and San Diego, et cetera.
Dave, we're just about out of time. I'm sorry. Tough sell getting those big lines in. A few last words, Henry?
Yeah, it is, unfortunately. I mean, I guess it's a similar phenomenon writ large, which is that it involves a heavy degree of government subsidy, and it forces people to ask questions that I think go beyond what makes sense economically and sort of start thinking about social benefits and such things. And it's a similar thing. So,
Henry, thanks a lot for joining us.
Take care. Thank you.
That was Henry Grabar. He's urban affairs journalist in New York. He writes the Dream City column for Salon.
It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up on Central Time, we'll learn about the life of a Wisconsin legend, painter John Stewart Curry.
First, when the Social Security program for disabled children began in 1974, it was a little-known effort that largely provided cash to families with severely physically disabled children. The aim was to assist parents who couldn't work as a result of their child's disability.
Today, new data shows that the program, known as SSI, has eclipsed traditional welfare programs to become the biggest source of monthly cash assistance for the nation's poorest families.
The disabilities covered have also been broadened to include things like attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, autism spectrum disorders, and depression. Advocates say that it is one of the last remaining programs that hasn't faced harsh cuts by the federal government, but others say it has simply replaced welfare since reforms in the mid-90s.
David Wittenberg is with us now. He's senior researcher at Mathematica Policy Research. David, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate the opportunity to talk about this important issue.
Well, before we break into the details, is the fact that this program has grown so much, eclipsing many other welfare programs, is this seen as a problem in our federal government?
It's hard to say if it's a problem. I think the basic question that's arising on all sides of the debate is SSI's changing role in the safety net, and clearly by the overview that you just provided, the Child SSI program is playing a much larger role relative to supports that were previously provided to low-income families, particularly the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families program. And I think the reason why you're seeing so much spotlight on this issue is precisely because the Child SSI recipients have grown by approximately 50% from 880,000 youth to 1.3 million youth since 1997 in the absence of any eligibility changes for the program.
So when this started back before that, about 40 years ago, it was even smaller still. What did this program look like at the outset?
Well, at the outset, actually, it had started in 1974, and as Ed Berkowitz described in his book on the history of the Child SSI program, the eligibility requirements for children were actually thought of as kind of an afterthought. And until the 1990s, the program remained to be quite small, well under 200,000, and it wasn't thought of as a major safety net program. And then there was a series of expansions, particularly through court cases and changes in the mental impairments listings that substantially increased the eligibility for children with disabilities in the 1990s. That was eventually curtailed somewhat in 1996.
But so the program has risen. Is part of the concern that this is happening, this growth is happening, we're doing this, but there hasn't been really a lot of policy thought put into, is this the most effective way to help the people in this way?
I think that is kind of precisely the question is a lot of this growth has occurred completely in the absence of policy changes. When I say a lot of this growth, I'm speaking specifically of the growth since 1997. And I should probably be very careful here because there was a large amount of growth following the Supreme Court decision for Brian Zebley in the early 1990s that substantially expanded and changed the eligibility definition for children with disabilities. And so there was a big period in this early 90s where there was an expansion. And then since 1997, there hasn't been any eligibility changes. And to put this into context, the program grew from approximately 200,000 youth in the early 90s to 800,000 youth 1997. And from 1997 to 2013, we've seen another substantial growth, but there hasn't been any policy change. So I think it's important to really distinguish between those two periods and thinking about the program.
Sure. Well, something that happened around that time in the mid-90s, a big welfare reform, changes to eligibility to a lot of the more traditional programs we wrap up under the rubric welfare. There's a worry now from critics, I gather, that this is kind of a sneaky way to provide benefits that may have been lost then to more people now without the same guidelines.
I think that there is definitively a changing role in this safety net, and I think that this is sort of a hotly contested issue. So I think this really gets at the role of policies in serving low-income families. And following welfare reform, you had a major change in policies at the state level, where there was an increasing emphasis on work requirements and time limits generally through the TANF program for low-income families. And following that at that same time, the TANF caseloads dropped substantially. And so, in part, some of the growth you can argue with SSI is perfectly expected, and particularly given state incentives for serving low-income families, as well as families and youth incentives for obtaining benefits. And I think the one thing to be very careful here is sometimes people confuse incentives with frauds of whether or not people are, quote-unquote, deserving. I think it's really important to take this picture that we're seeing in the changing safety net and say to yourself, okay, what is exactly going on? We certainly have this one broad set of programs that appear to be contracting, and people are looking for alternative supports. And some of those people may have been on those other programs in the absence of the child SSI program. And when you look at the incentives, I think that those incentives are really pointing more squarely at the child SSI program expanding.
Well, some of the reporting I've seen of the people involved in this program might be a parent with kids who could use some kind of federal help, and the kid might be on the borderline of an ADHD diagnosis, maybe yes, maybe no. The incentive from this program is get that diagnosis, get the medication, and then you are eligible. Not fraud, as you were saying, but maybe a perverse incentive.
Yeah, I think that there is a concern about perverse incentives, and I think that we can certainly say that there are challenges with potential incentives pointing at the child SSI program, but we don't know the precise issues that are driving the growth, because there are these variations, and there's particularly large variations at the state level, which makes sort of tracking this growth especially challenging. For example, in your own state, in Wisconsin, there's been a 25% growth in child SSI recipients from 17,500 to 23,000, whereas in Texas, and I should say that's from 1997 to 2013, in Texas, over that same period, you see a 300% growth rate in child SSI youth from 50,000 to 150,000 youth. So clearly there are some very big changes and very big differences going on across states. So I want to be very careful in distinguishing between we know what is going on and the actual incentives themselves, because I think that there's some additional complexities that are going on beyond potentially the youth incentives and their families' incentives to apply for benefits.
Well, in trying to untangle all this down the road, it seems like the priority would be, okay, how do we meet the needs of the families we want to meet the needs of without throwing money in the wrong directions and making sure that the future needs of the kids with disabilities are being met? What's the next step? How do you start getting there?
Yeah, I think that you phrased that quite well, which is, and if I could use some of the terminologies, is how do you deal with some of the very positive effects of the child SSI's program in alleviating poverty? The child SSI check comprises half of the family's income, and so we should keep in mind that the youth that are in these families receiving SSI are coming from very low income families, and it's often their only source of support. But we have to balance it with these incentives. And I think it's really thinking about what the investment is in these children. So it is, can we develop alternative incentives rather than focusing solely on their disability, focusing much more on their ability and their potential for working in education, and design a set of supports that address this, maybe the very necessary short-term poverty needs of the family, but also consider what are the long-term implications for the child and the child's family in terms of providing SSI supports. And it's, this gets to an issue they haven't really talked too much about the long-term implications of child SSI benefit receipt.
Before we let you go, this is a complicated problem. There are a lot of competing priorities at the federal level. Is anybody starting to make a move to tackle this and make some of the changes you're looking for there?
Well, I'm happy to say that there have been some moves to test initiatives such as the youth transition demonstration that the Social Security has funded, and the promoting readiness for SSI recipients, which are demonstrations that are still in the field that provide employment-based supports to child SSI recipients to promote employment outcomes. But some of the information from those interventions have actually suggested some positive impacts, suggesting that particularly with the youth transition demonstration, that it might be that there might be positive implications providing employment supports to promote employment outcomes. But there hasn't been a fuller scale test of testing alternative benefit tracks to youth with disabilities. And I think that in the absence of that evidence, it's hard to know really what works and how best to serve these youth.
David, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much for your time. I appreciate it.
That was David Wittenberg. He's senior researcher at Mathematica Policy Research. We've been talking about new data showing that Social Security for children with disabilities has eclipsed traditional welfare programs to become really the biggest source of monthly cash assistance for the nation's poorest families. Time for Wisconsin Legends, where we take a look at some of the most noteworthy people who at some point called Wisconsin their home.
Today we're talking about famed regionalist artist John Stewart Curry. As a young painter, he came to Madison in 1936 to become the nation's first artist in residence at an American university, and he fell in love with Wisconsin.
He channeled that love into sweeping paintings of Wisconsin landscapes, many of which have now been curated into a new exhibit at the Museum of Wisconsin Art. It's called John Stewart Curry at Home in Wisconsin.
Joining us now to talk about Curry's life and to tell us about the new exhibit is Graham Reed, Director of Collections and Exhibitions at the Museum of Wisconsin Art in West Bend. Graham, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
Well, it would be great to take complete credit for Curry here in Wisconsin, but he wasn't actually from Wisconsin. Can you talk us about tell us about what his early life was like before he got to our state?
Well, Curry actually grew up on a farm just outside Dunavant in Kansas and was born there in 1897. But he went to he was in Kansas, then he was in New York, then he was in Westport, Connecticut. And in 1936, he really kind of got an offer that he could not refuse. I think he was basically unhappy on the East Coast and I think was yearning to get back to the Midwest. And then when Dean Chris Christensen of the College of Agriculture at UW-Madison called him with an offer that Curry couldn't refuse. And so basically it was to be the first artist in residence at an American university. It was $4,000 a year, custom-made studio, no teaching requirements. But the kind of... you could say basically his charge was to be a force for rural culture within the state. And it was very much part of what you would call the Wisconsin idea, and that was that there should be a much closer relationship between the Ivory Tower, UW-Madison, the academic side of the state, and also the rural side of the state, which was, you know, predominantly rural, predominantly agriculture. And I think what was groundbreaking was that even though kind of biochemistry and agriculture obviously seemingly had a much more direct relationship, or certainly had a closer and more practical relationship than the arts. Chris Christensen firmly believed that the arts and culture were very much part of an education, and that Curry was the man to do that. He was going to work closely with rural artists throughout the state and encourage them to pursue their vocation, even though that may not have been their actual occupation.
Well, it's amazing that the first artist in residence in the country was not in an art school, but in the UW's agriculture school. And he's inventing this job in a way. How did he put this artist in residence for the Ag College into practice?
Well, they built him a studio, which was actually paid for by the state. He was kind of charged with doing his own work, interacting with students, but then very much getting out into the rural parts of the state and bringing artists to Madison. And there's a wonderful story that I read about, he was actually a miner from Illinois, of all places, Vashel Davis, who sent some drawings to Curry and pretty much on a whim, and I'm sure he expected to hear nothing in reply, but Curry saw the drawings, liked them, and invited this miner from El Dorado, Illinois, to come there. And so I'm sure this miner was just pinching himself as he's sitting there in Curry's studio working on his work, while Curry is across the other side of the room working on his work. And, you know, I think temperamentally, I think Curry was the ideal person for this position, because when Curry first went to art school at the Kansas City Art Institute, I think he was very much perceived and treated as an outsider. I think he was kind of regarded as, well, here's this farm boy, you know, what's he doing here? So I think, you know, Curry, I think through that experience, kind of knew what it felt to be kind of from the outside looking in on the art world. And so I think that very much informed his attitude when he was working with the rural artists in the state, to say, I know what it's like to be kind of perceived as being outside of the art world, and I'm going to help welcome you in to the art world. And so I think that was a huge part of why Curry was so successful at Madison.
Well, can you tell us about some of the pieces of art that may have come out of his time at the university?
Well, we've actually got a lot of things in the exhibition that have never been either shown publicly before or haven't been together in decades. And one of the things that I think really exemplifies Curry's role within the kind of Wisconsin idea and the life of the university was in 1941, he was commissioned to do a series of murals for the biochemistry department. And we have the original full-scale drawings of the central panel. And this features people like Stephen Babcock, Elmer McCollum, E.B. Hart. I mean, these were all people, scientists at the university, who came up with things like vitamin A, the single grain experiment. I mean, these were people who had a major, major impact on life in Wisconsin. And so here's Curry doing those. We have four of the five drawings that Curry did for the 1941 Badger Yearbook, which was dedicated by the students to Curry. And then we have five fantastic football images, one being the only surviving football painting that Curry ever did. But there are four drawings that go along with this, two which relate specifically to two players in the painting, and then two sketches that are much more kind of sophisticated renderings of the painting. We have the three large paintings that Curry did in 1941 for First National Bank, which are now owned by the Chazen Museum, the Madison Museum of Contemporary Art, and the Milwaukee Art Museum. These three large paintings haven't been together in decades. Let's see, what else do we have? We also have probably one of the most iconic paintings, not just, I think, in Curry's career, but also in really 20th century American art, and that is the painting Our Good Earth, which he did in 1941-42, and which was actually used as a promotional image for war bonds during the Second World War. And it's kind of a farmer standing, you know, defiantly in his field with his two children by his side, clutching three strands of grain. And you can really look at the painting in two ways. One, you can look at it as being Curry painting basically his connection to the landscape and his knowledge of farming and farmers that he would have gleaned as he went around the state. But you can also look at it very much from the point of view as, this was the home front. This is the heartland. It's the Midwest. This is what the Second World War, in many respects, was being fought for. This is the home front. You're fighting for basically the motherland. And so it's a tremendously powerful image, not only of from Curry's direct experience within the state, but really on a larger national context of what the war was being fought for. So we've got, you know, we've got things that, as I say, have never been shown publicly before. We also have his last mural that was done in 1946 for a livestock barn at Wisconsin State Fair Park. And fortunately, this was rescued by a gentleman called Elmer Schultz, because this thing otherwise would have ended up in a dumpster.
Wow. Graham, it sounds like a great exhibit. Thank you so much for sharing his work with us today.
You're welcome. Thank you so much for calling.
That's Graham Reed. He's the Director of Collections and Exhibitions at the Museum of Wisconsin Art in West Bend. He's the curator of the exhibit we've been talking about, John Stuart Curry, At Home in Wisconsin.